adding room to the other guys.
All right. Thanks very much, everyone. Exciting. This is, of course, a very personal take on it. You may as well be. You may as well get bored. Okay, last week we had many talks on dark matter and light new particles as well. So this is more on the side of light new particles, not so much dark matter. So my interest in this stems from the precision tests of QED. That's a somewhat archaic name, but it has been done recently with a new system, lamp shift in muonic hydrogen. It shows a large discrepancy compared to what people have expected, and that generated quite a bit of frantic activity in nuclear physics and some layers of low-energy particle physics community. I will talk about this, and then maybe also, and I will talk about the paper I had with Dave McKean, a postdoc at Victoria at that time, on a new proposal on how to measure parity violation in neutral currents in muonic atoms. And that's one of the standard model processes that hasn't been measured at all, and it's quite quite interesting for me. Again, the preliminary things towards this parity measurement will be done this year at Paul Scherrer Institute in PSI on June 22nd to June 29. There will be 1 week of beam time, and I will go there as well. So if I come back, you know, with my hands like heavily bandaged like that, that means that I was doing a lot. What is this? What is that, right? Anyways, all right. ARC stands for atomic radiative capture, and I'll tell you in this later what it is. So it's an interesting picture transpires with muons in neutral currents. Or in the neutron channels, rather. If we look at the charge channels, like searches of mu to e gamma or mu to 3, there is no deviation from the standard model. You have basically measured zero. But in terms of the other observables, somewhat of a neutral channel like G minus 2, there is a large discrepancy, 3.5 sigma discrepancy between the state-of-the-art calculations and measurements. There is an old measurement in radiative muon capture by Triumph that seems to be off quite a bit from what's expected, which it's a charged channel, but you add a photon and that's why I put it in the neutral category. So there is a discrepancy there. There is also, this newer discrepancy from 2010, very famous now, a measurement of lamp shift in muonic atoms, and it stands at formally now at 7 sigma discrepancy with and so you wonder what's going on. Among besides checking the existing calculations, you also want to maybe have some bets on maybe some of it comes from new physics, right? Because that's the ultimate goal, is to test their model and find new physics. So if we place this new physics on this, again, the plot with explores like the mass of the new mediator force and the strength of the new mediator force, we have lots of options. So there is a lot of this can sit at small mass, high masses, small large couplings, and that's the goal of intensity frontier, but energy frontier. But there could be situations where there is a small coupling, say 10 minus 3, but the masses of mediators are in the MeV range. This is what Philip was talking about last week, and there could be, you know, pockets of resistance, something that's not excluded in this sort of stellar model backyard. So if you look at this from this perspective, that discrepancy over here with G minus 2 of the muon could have been induced by either weak scale physics or the light scale physics. And this discrepancy is over here if this is new physics, that it can only come from light particles because it requires some interactions at the level of 1,000 times or more stronger than G Fermi. Okay. So sometimes I'd say that testing the very specific hypothesis for new physics occurs on the faster time scale than figuring out whether your 3.5 sigma discrepancy is real or not, right? Because that thing requires a painstaking sort of understanding of strong interactions in case of the muon, because through loops it's sensitive to strong interactions. But this proposal of the new light vector particle kinetically mixed with the photon that I had in 2008 in connection with G minus 2, that thing you can see by now has been firmly ruled out. So there is, in the new physics case, it's often that you can, you know, advance the subject faster than you can understand the actual origin for the discrepancy. And it could have been that it could be detected, right? So this is a somewhat speculative take on it, but I think it serves a right general purpose. All right, so let's get to the main topic of the talk, and these are exotic atoms. And for example, the neat thing about it, if you take the charge to a particle, a negatively charged particle, like, well, there is half of the muons and negatively charged, and you put it inside the atom, it goes deep inside and probes the inner structure of the atom. 2.5 microseconds gives a lot of time. It's really infinite from the time scale of many atomic transitions, so it gives you a lot of leverage on studying the structure of atom from the inside. And there's been long-standing exploration of the properties of nuclei using muons that's by now more or less finished. I'll tell you what it is in a second. Now, in the 90s, there was kind of a change in the emphasis a little bit that just studying the structure of the nucleus, people have started doing the laser manipulations with exotic atoms. It usually works that you have an atom in some metastable state, and you come to this with the laser. And if you do something with in resonance, then you you know, like with the antihydrogen, that you pull it out of the trap in resonance, and it goes to the wall and gives you a big flash. So this has led to some interesting measurements, and a lot of QCD data also, I should say, come from the exotic atoms, like the pion scattering lengths and so on. So as soon as our Stringer colleagues solve QCD, this, which is soon, I hope, this data will all become very handy. Anyways, so this is how the muon business works. So if you take a slab of material, send the mu plus there, it will stop and stay there until it dies. Okay, so mu minus, on the other hand, comes in, replaces an electron, and because its equilibrium orbit is much lower than electrons, it emits a lot of gammas, and that is called the muonic cascade. So it's always like that. Muon stops, replaces an outer electron on the orbit commensurate with the electron orbit, sort of on the Bohr radius size, and then cascades down. So from the classical perspective, this would be an inspiraling muon And this picture is not drawn to scale because it takes many millions of rotations before it goes from one level to another. And in the quantum regime, this inspiraling process actually corresponds to a maximal L available for any given n. So this, if you picture the muon progression from upper levels to lower levels, it always prefers to go on the outside. Okay, so this is what's called the muonic cascades. And this muonic cascades are the only known ways to make muonic atoms. So there is quite a bit of variety in muonic atoms as well. If you take a proton and attach a muon to it, the binding energy will be like 2.5 keV or so. And the distance here, Bohr radius in that you know, in this system would be the inverse of alpha times mu. So it's inverse of 1 MeV roughly, so it's at the scale of 200 Fermi. So it's 200 times further away than the radius of the proton itself. But this is yet 200 times closer than the electron sits in the same hydrogen atom, but with an electron. So, but if you take other atoms like lead or some heavy atoms, the muonic orbit is deeply inside the nucleus, which is completely not the case for electrons. So there is a wide morphological variety to this. And emitted gammas, depending on where you are, can range from X-rays to the, say, in case of lead, it goes all the way up to 10 MeV. Oh yes, it is inside the nucleus, and it lives there quite a while. Yes. So as I said, over the years, there's been you know, if you want to calculate that accurately, these energy levels, you would be using an exact with quantum corrections and everything. This would be quite a challenging calculation, taking an exact propagator in the field that is not even the Coulomb, right? But some funny shaped electric field. So there's been a lot of work done in that direction, actually. To go to the case of muonic hydrogen, which is the most interesting in connection with this recent discrepancy. And the one thing that is different from the textbook stuff on Lem shift, this is a n equals two subsystem of levels. So this is one thing that is different from the textbook stuff in normal hydrogen. Normal hydrogen, the 2s state is pushed above than the 2p state by diagrams with the self interaction of electron. Here, on the other hand, is pulled down by the polarization of the electron vacuum, and that's stays out of the sort of the main difference between the 2s and 2p is that scale. Okay, so 0.2 electron volts, and there is a big drop. Four orders of magnitude larger to the ground state, which is 2 keV separated from all that. Okay. One thing you can ask: why is the sign of the muonic hydrogen Lamb shift is different from the electron thing? So I tried to picture that. So for muons, you polarize the electron vacuum, and so the size scale of the momentum of the muon on the orbit is alpha times m muon, so it's roughly 1 MeV, which is very commensurate with the size of that loop that occurs on the Compton wavelength of the electron. So, and that's, if you think about it, due to the running of the coupling, it actually gives an effectively, you probe it gives an effectively negative correction. So it's an extra attraction generated by what's called Serber Euling potential. And for electrons themselves, they sit much further. The size of that loop is much smaller, and this is a small correction compared to the process when the photon is emitted and absorbed by electron. So I tried to actually picture these corrections in units of MeV. So distance is inverse MeV. This is the potential times R squared. I multiply the potential times R squared because R squared dr is the measure in your spherical integral. So it's kind of appropriate to weight it with R squared because it gives you the area under this curve give you a correction to the energy levels once you directly convoluted with the wave function. So this is the celebrated Euling-Serber potential derived in 1935. So it's the first quantum calculation of a kind. I mean, quantum field theory calculations. And here I tried to put it on a log linear scale. So what happens is that here is this Euling-Serber potential. It's the same thing, just plotted slightly differently. But once you go inside the proton size, there is a big effectively bump because the charge is not concentrated now on the in the point, but rather spread out. That gives an effective repulsive interaction relative to the Coulomb. So the average of this blue curve with the squares of the wave functions give you the difference, and you can see that the lamp shift, and you can see that the square of the wave function is where this is the most negative. It's the S state that. This is not. It's a correction to the. It's a deviation from the Coulomb potential. That's right, because this is alpha squared, additional alpha, right? I mean, besides alpha over r, that's in the Coulomb, it's alpha over pi, right? So the. Well, that's already everything is there. I multiplied by r squared, right? So that's you should keep in mind. Okay, so r squared kills anything that goes to zero. But if the wave function would be just a step function like that, the area under this curve would just directly give you the lamp shift. So this part, as I say, is completely fixed by QCD, QED. Then this part is unknown, and it's to be extracted from experiment. So there's no ab initio calculation of the charge radius. So it's interesting to think that the first calculations were done by the guys who would later on do a much more famous tree-level calculations, and this particular Serber has bitten everyone to that, and is the author of, at that time they did not formulate it as a loop, right? But it's an excitation and de-excitation of virtual excitation, de-excitation of the electron-positron vacuum, but later on he was super important in that business, right? So to calculating the diffusion length of neutrons in uranium. I leave it to you to figure out why that was important. Anyways, just 70, and yes, and of course he did not apply this potential to muonic hydrogen because muons were not discovered at that time, right? So not in 1935. So in 2010, just 75 years after Serber, the measurement has been done, and it's been in the news quite a bit at that time, not least because it was very discrepant from what you would expect, based from what was already known about the charge radius. So maybe I'll spend a minute or two on describing how the experiment works. So this is here you see this cascade going through, and 99% of the photons, they all just drop to 1s level very quickly, but 1% gets stuck in the 2s state. And again, some trivia from your quantum mechanics classes, the 2s state is long-lived because M1 transition to the ground state is highly suppressed. There are only two photon transitions and so on. And that's useful because you can come in with a laser, and if it's in resonance, you shake it, it goes to the 2p state, and you detect it by this thing emitting an X-ray of 2 keV. So that's the principle of the experiment. Easy to say. This relies on the long-lived 2s state. What we should you should keep in mind why it took them 20 years to actually succeed in measuring this is that experiment is very difficult for the following reason. The muons come out of the pion decays and so on with the 50 MeV momentum, right? To stop them, you actually need some considerable amount of material. However, if you have a considerable density of hydrogen gas, then the collisional time scale is very short. And the next coming atom, its electric field mixes 2s and 2p state and quenches the 2s state. So you can do this only in a very rarefied environment, which is extremely difficult then to stop muons, right? So they have an inverse cyclotron. So they decelerate muons before they come in, paying a huge penalty in the total number counts of muons coming in. Anyways, this is their sort of most exciting plot. So this is a log of the number of muons. This is an aggregated plot after a lot of running. So this is the time in microseconds. So all the cascade guys, they peak here. And then there is a small fraction that gets stuck in the 2s state. And then they fire a laser sometime later. And if it laser in resonance, then you see the increase in the x-rays of these 2 keV x-rays. This is not to scale, right? This is 0.3 MeV, this is 2 keV, right? So there you see the increase in X-rays. And again, this is on resonance, it's 6 events per hour. So imagine you try to find the resonance with your radio, right? You just turn the knob back and forth. You hear something, and here's your resonance. So now, imagine now you have a radio that has the radio station emits 6 phonons per hour, right? And your background is 1 phonon per hour, right? And that tells you that you better know where to look, because otherwise it's
the radio works with phonons.
Well, you hear phonons, right? I mean, it's
that radio station emits phonons.
But you don't hear photons, do you? I mean, that's the direct analog, right? So basically, that makes this experiment extremely difficult. So the rumor says that been going over and over the range where they expected the resonance to be for many years. And also, your radio is very expensive and is given to you 2 weeks a year, right? So that's another thing, right? Finally, once they broadened the search, they found a beautiful resonance. That's their centroid of the resonance. The charge radius is determined this way. Since then, they published two lines from different components of hyperfine splitting. So the error bars you can't even see. They're really self-consistent. So they measure this lamp shift. The QED part is all well known. They calculate that you extract charge radius of the proton as the input parameter. And these are all treatments sort of prior to this, so or around that time. So this is CoData is the group that compiles all the constants of nature, so to speak, in one big booklet, and they do quite a bit of their own data analysis as well. So in terms of the CoData error bars, it's seven sigma away. So that's a big problem.
Sorry,
yes?
CoData is which experiment again?
CoData is an average, right? So they put away the muonic hydrogen, right? They decided not to use it, right? Okay. And then they basically average the hydrogen, the hydrogen spectroscopy results, normal hydrogen, and the electron proton scattering things. In both cases, I mean, it sounds a little bit more dramatic than it actually is. So there is a lot of room that for that something could have gone wrong, right? There could be errors. This is, for example, normal hydrogen spectroscopy. These are results for normal hydrogen lamp shift and the various transitions. Now the charge radius comes in as, and this is the muonic hydrogen result. The charge radius of the proton comes in as a fit parameter together with the Rydberg constant. On the line by line basis, there is no dramatic discrepancy. But once you include them all, assuming that there is uncorrelated systematic errors, then you can see that this is like a four sigma discrepant. Okay. Then there is a lot of work being done all over the world now to trying to increase accuracy in the individual measurements. Because if you really can, at York, for example, people are trying to remeasure the lamp shift. If you can do it, if you can shrink the error bars here by a factor of three or so, that would be just by itself a direct test of what's going on. So the scattering is a messy business. There has been a large data set obtained by MINDS A1 experiment that my colleagues here know very well. It looks like, the error bars are very, very big. But this, the number of data points there is huge. So the results are kind of dominated by systematic errors. I mean, accounting for them is a painstaking business, and several groups have done it. So let's just show you the paper that appears today, right? By yet another analysis, that's scattering, right? So you can see that their suggested average that includes various imperfections in merging various data sets is still 3.5 sigma above the muonic hydrogen results, and it's basically you should take that, and it's independent from the hydrogen spectroscopy.
What is the right column?
It's a magnetic charge radius. Oh. So there is also a measurement of the magnetic charge radius that you can do. I should also say that this data over here, where is this, are also self-consistent in the following sense that they've measured it. They've measured transitions from both components of hyperfine. You can take the difference and see whether this is consistent with what's known about the hyperfine transition, and it's sensitive to a distribution of a magnetic dipole and so on, and it's very, very consistent. So that's the nature of the problem. Everyone is kind of scratching their heads. Some people say, well, this is the most important problem in front of nuclear physics right now, which I don't think it is, but it's very intriguing. Yes?
Are the individual measurements typically dominated by systematics, or is it a mix of systematics?
I think we talked about this a while ago.
The for scattering or for the muon, you know, the hydrogen, there is no systematics, right? I mean, really, I mean, this is it's dominated by statistics, right? But for the other things, it's systematics, right? So especially for measuring hydrogen, which is easily polarizable thing, to high accuracy, right? A normal hydrogen. This is extremely difficult, right? So it's not statistics at all. It's systematics. And the scattering, the experiments, after MINDS, size of the MINDS data set is, again, it's systematic error.
But presumably there are different systematics for the two measurements.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, absolutely different.
So if you were to draw the expected...
This is not the whole set. It's just a snapshot. They have lots of data at different Q-squares. Yes.
Okay. But if you were to trace over that, what the expected distributed shape would be, assuming the charge radius given from the muonic data,
That's very easy. That's very easy. If you have only scattering and muonic charge data, you will end up saying this, that my charge distribution looks like this. There is something distributed at one Fermi, and there is a slight, sliver of charge that continues further out, probably with a negative value. That will fit the both, right? But then for that, you would need to kind of think that this charge distribution
right.
continues to 200 Fermi or something like that, which is the model of new physics, if you like, right? Because that never happens in QCD. But yes, you can if you play completely with the shape of the charge distribution, you can fit it. But you would need to go to a large Q square that are not accessible at MINDS.
Yeah, no, sorry, but
at small Q square.
Actually, what's the expectation on that? How different would the data?
You would not notice it by eye, right?
Okay.
That's but this is the thing when you have a very powerful statistical data set that I have seen fits with different charge radii that look to me okay, and the experts were saying no. It gives a chi-square of 1.5, and it's terrible because we have a chi-square of 1.04, right? So this is, all right. So, okay, I got to move on, all right? Right, ridges, yes. So that's origin of the discrepancy. So the calculation has been checked all over again. There's nothing there. I mean, this is by far not, muonic hydrogen is by far not the most challenging calculation, right? To 1%, I do it with my students in quantum mechanics class, right? I mean, this is really like averaging Euling potential over and adding the contribution, the repulsive contribution from the charge radius. So it's very easy, but it's being pushed to much higher accuracy. You can ask the question: what about the QCD? Right? At some point, you have a lepton. There is two photons, and there is a black box. There's QCD, right? So at some point, you have to face a strong interaction business. So that's been looked at by generations of physicists through dispersion relations. So there's a lot of data on photo production that you can use sort of dissect this diagram by half and represent it by the square of this. Unfortunately, there is also a subtraction function, not just a constant as usually there are in dispersion relation, but it's something like if there would be two photons merging to a sigma boson and getting straight to the proton, this is something you cannot dissect. But that's been calculated in some models that we believe are right, chiral perturbation theory models, and the input for that goes again from measuring the nucleon polarizabilities at JLab. So the results are all between all groups are very self-consistent, and the result of this two photon exchange diagram are all in this range of minus 35. And to fix the discrepancy, you need something like minus 300. It just doesn't appear feasible. What I like about this group, that these are atomic people, they say, well, we don't know what you guys are doing. We're going to do completely different story. We take naive quark model, we tune it such that it gives correct predictions for, you know, mass and radius and such, and we calculate the two photon exchange diagram. You say, well, I don't trust this model, but it gives the very same results, very same numbers, not even like same order of magnitude, same numbers. This is very impressive. So, but there were suggestions, maybe you know, some extravagant suggestions that maybe somehow we can modify these things in that large Q squared so that the problem goes away. Then it's if that's the case, then the point I'd like to make, then you paid your moving company for nothing, right? So there is being a big push in G minus 2 of the muon, and the huge metal ring being transported from BNL to Fermilab, trying to redo the experiment at a considerable cost. And if we just say, oh, QCD, Brown, Mach, there is a contribution here, a coefficient, then corrections from that to the muon G minus 2 are actually gigantic. So if you've given up on proton charge radius, saying, well, QCD cannot be understood, there is no chance you can understand G minus 2 at the same level. I just mentioned here the new physics attempts now. So there's like, okay, if everything else is excluded, what can it be, right? Maybe it's new physics. I do not for a second seriously believe that this must be new physics. This is at this point, just a logical exploration of what can it be, right? So the difficulty stems from the fact that you need a very large effect, that you need 10 to the 3 times G Fermi, right? So it's naively you'd say, well, it's a contact interaction between the muon and the proton, but something that stands in front is the 10 to the 3 times G Fermi, and that's difficult to arrange. The dark photon that we all sort of come to appreciate here, it can actually help in explaining the difference between the charge radius of the in the scattering and the charge radius in the muonic atoms, but it's it would generally predict this type of hierarchy. What's observed is this. So then, therefore, you have to do something really fancy, invent new interactions that couple two muons, and here comes the straitjacket that the nature gives you. The Einsteiner model, the leptons are organized in right-handed doublets and left-handed doublets that include neutrinos, right? Neutrinos definitely do not have any interactions that are stronger than Fermi scale. Therefore, you kind of push towards introducing new, if new physics comes from a new vector exchange, light vector at the MeV scale, then it has to couple to the right-handed muon. So this is no feat, because this theory becomes anomalous and strongly coupled at some scales of 10 TeV or so. So this is really not a beautiful model, but some other people like Itai have tried scalars. So with all this models, there is a problem of UV completion, proper UV completion.
How do you UV complete this? I mean, you have to have the Higgs charge under this.
That's right. You would have to have a Higgs as well, right? So this thing.
You have to have a separate Higgs for the.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Oh. Yes. So this is. But if this is the Higgs, this would be the least of the worries. So there is like a strong interaction at the TeV. There is for this thing a lot for scalars. for scalars, there are issues with couplings to neutrons and so on. So there's a lot of issues with it in this model. But I was pressing with it nevertheless, because this model has something really funny. It has an interaction with the right-handed muons, therefore enhancement of parity violation in for muons. So the thing is that if you see something that is separated from the standard model by symmetries, right? If you see the violation of parity with the strength exceeding G Fermi by many orders of magnitude, then you'd know that you discover new physics. So I was hopeful and still am that one can test muons using parity violation in neutral currents. And of course, the parity violation in charged currents is known very well. So let's just back in 2011, we come up with some benchmark points for these models. Those are tuned points, but that they were passing all the constraints that we could think at that time. But since then, we have put more work. Last year, we have able to exclude a couple of more points. So there is this model. If it's true, then it exists only by a thread, and it's tuned. There's an interesting comment for, you know, this nuclear part of the community. They play with it this way. They say, oh, why? I mean, we don't care about the UV completion. We just put in a new interaction, vector interaction to the muons. Forget the neutrino. We're just going to live like that. But then what happens is that if you really break standard model gauge invariance, then you gotta go to the processes that occur in the standard model and use gauge invariance and occur at high energy. So if you, for example, go to this process of mu nu of W decaying to mu nu, and there is muon in the neutrino line, and you emit a vector that is coupled to a vector current here, you would get the rate that was going to be scaling as mw over mv squared. So it gets this huge enhancement, and so basically, kills this theory. And so if you just put it by hand, not worrying putting things in the proper standard model representations, they just trivial particle physics kills you right away. So we have put that these comments in this paper that compiles very many constraints. So this is the process I was talking about, and it in this naive picture with vector current to muons, it actually excludes all the models outright. So one comment that I wanted to make also about the scalar particles, this was Itai's proposal to have interaction like that. It provides, it also does the same thing, provides the additional attraction force for muons. It couples differently to electrons muons, so that could be a reason why we see discrepancy in muonic hydrogen. And the couplings to electrons and protons are kind of small, 10 to the minus 8. But, if it's decays 2e plus e minus, this is already in the firmly excluded region by various fixed target experiments. So Gordon, Eder, and I thought, well, what if it's below 1 MeV and it's sort of that doesn't decay to e plus e minus all that easily? And we came up with the idea that one can put the nuclear accelerators next to the large detectors like Borexina and Super-K and so on underground, and completely explore this region of couplings in this model preferred by this explanation that Itai has put forward. So now in the remaining 15 minutes or so, I'd like to discuss parity violation in neutral currents for muons. So this is being a classic subject, actually. First, It first came up in the early 70s, right after the discovery of neutral currents, but it was not pushed through. That never happened experimentally, not for the lack of trying. But it would be a nice addition to this general picture. If there is a discrepancy, that would be interesting to know. If there is, by any chance, a model that, you know, breaks parity at the level stronger than G Fermi, that would be an ambiguous, new physics. So that's my motivation. So test of parity for muons in neutral currents is extremely difficult. And let me go over muon scattering first. So when we wrote this paper with Dave and Brian, with this three sort of representative parameter space points that fix the G minus two, sorry, that fix muoning hydrogen Lamb shift, we also calculated left-right parity-violating asymmetry, right? So the nature gives you a very perfect tool. The muons come out of the pion decays polarized, right? So their momentum and the spins are aligned, right? So this is a consequence of only one-handedness for neutrinos. So that's being used, of course, and we thought, well, why can't you use it for studying parity? So you send muons polarized this way and that way, and you predict asymmetries at in these models at the level of 10 to the minus 3. And for electrons, detecting asymmetries at the level of 10 to the minus 8 in the scattering, 10 to the minus 7, is not a problem. So you think that it should be done easily. But the problem occurs because the muons come polarized, but only with one polarization, right? And so to flip this polarization reliably, which is essential for these measurements, it's not possible because you apply the magnetic field and the spin flips, but the muon also, the direction also flips. So it turns out that this is completely unrealistic. There is a lot of R&D going on in Japan for taking mu plus, completely cooling it down to the stage of muonium when it attracts an electron and forms this mu e atom. Then you can manipulate the spin and strip the electron and reaccelerate all in 2.5 microseconds, and that's a big piece of R&D, which they want to do the new G minus 2 experiment with that, but the parity measurement would be actually easier than G minus 2 if this beam is developed. Another possibility for the scattering would be to have this large ring that is at Fermi Lab and have some internal target that is not destroying the muonic beam gas target that you could since the direction of the spin is monitored, you would know you would be able to measure the parity violating asymmetry. Last subject I wanted to talk about is this proposal that we have with Dave McKean on how to do it in muonic atoms. The parity violation business is difficult because everything is proportional to G Fermi. Then, if you want a symmetry, it's multiplied by characteristic Q squared, which is Z alpha and mu in muonic atoms. So if you don't have an enhancement, the answer is as small as 10 to the minus 7. So people have thought about enhancing the signal in strongly forbidden 2S1S transition. And that goes back to the classic papers by Chen and Feinberg. And there's a lot of work has been done in that direction. And that's not working or didn't work out. And our proposal is to use a slightly different scheme, sort of this old proposal is based on having the muonic cascade when the muon comes in, enters the cascade, some of it sort of hangs at the 2S level, and you look for 2S, 1S transition there. It turns out that it's all very well hidden under the background. And the our idea is to avoid the background by taking the penalty in the total rate. So if you have a very thin target, you have a possibility of capturing the muon in the muonic atom in flight. So the muon passes through and not have the thickness of the target is small, so it doesn't stop. So it goes from the flight right to 1S or 2S state and emitting in gamma. That would be like the first gamma that you detect, as and that's sort of a trigger for your second gamma, which is 2S, 1S, and that's the essence of the idea. So you have to go to Z's of 30 or larger, because before that, the 2S state is completely quenched by the Auger processes. And the previous attempts were all sort of zeroing in at Z equals 5, where the QED effects and the charge radius counterbalance so that the 2S, 2P states are highly degenerate. So these things are becoming very, the parity violation become asymmetry becomes very enhanced even for the standard model. However, when it's 2S, 2P states are degenerate by a few EV, there is no way on the one photon basis to tell the energy for whether it's 2S, 1S, or it's a main transition 2P, 1S. And where once you go to the 30 keV, the splitting becomes in the 50 keV range, which is, of course, very detectable with the germanium detectors. So when I started thinking about it, my ideas of the gamma lines were like beautiful stuff like that. So it's like a nice peak. But in fact, there is whenever you try to detect a gamma, there is this one peak. There are several other peaks, so it's called escape peaks, and there is a lot of continuum, right? So that creates a lot of background that is difficult. It makes the cascade measurements difficult. So this is the simulations done by Wouters from University of Washington. This is a cascade in zinc, and this is the 2S, 1S transition, and it's well hidden under the continuum generated by 3P, 1S, 4P, 1S, and whatever it's called, I think, Lyman, beta, gamma, and so on transition. So that's a main difficulty with the cascade idea. So what we propose is to avoid the cascade, avoid the huge backgrounds, capture the muons onto the 2S state directly out of flight. You take a big penalty in the number of muons that will do that, but you reduce the backgrounds. So this will be a new way of making muonic atoms, because never done that way, right? So that's what I call atomic radiative capture, or ARC, as opposed to just radiative capture, which is a nuclear process, okay? So you have to add atomic. So this is a very simple thing, emitting a gamma, getting in the ground state, so, or in the 2S state, and it's important that muons remain fully polarized. So the idea is to put a polarized muon onto the 2S state in one go. Once it's on the 2S state, you would look for 2S, 1S transition, and the asymmetries, the parity violating asymmetry, is the asymmetry for the emitting of photon in the forward direction relative to the backward direction. That would be a classic signature of the parity violation. Now, enhancements come in handy, right? The 2S, 2P states are, okay, split maybe by 100 keV, but it's still close compared to the main energy intervals there, which are more the level of a few MeV. And that enhances the parity violating mixing, because the closest levels are easier to mix. And then there is also a suppression of the main highly forbidden M1 transition, and that enhances the asymmetry because you admix E1 transition, which is highly allowed. So that's a standard thing in the parity violation measurements in atomic physics. Like I said, this is sort of a brave proposal, but you have to start somewhere, and you have to start by probably first detecting this process of capture of muon in flight into the 2S state. So this my friends at Triumph has taken some data with the Pi new setup with one day of running. But that's the beam at Triumph is a little too weak to and okay, I don't know because their data are blinded, so I don't know the result yet. Okay, so the according to our calculation, they should have 300 events from capturing into the ground state. We have done, of course, all the atomic calculations for the capture, where you have to take into account the Coulomb or Sommerfeld enhancement of the wave functions of incoming muon. So this is an upshot of the parity violation projections. So for the Stair model, if you want to dig down to the Stair model, the asymmetry of in the 2s 1s transition is at the level of 4.5 times 10 minus 4. So you need at least a billion events to be able to distinguish that, right? Because you have to have enough statistics. And but for new physics, this is not a small asymmetry that can be measured in nuclear physics. NPD gamma processes with differential emission of gamma along or opposite the neutron spin are measured to a smaller value. Now, the forward, the same asymmetry for new physics that comes to in the speculative fix for the charge radius of the muon problem of the proton problem that has enhanced values, so the asymmetry can be as large as 10%, in which case it would be seen very soon. So we have put together the sort of mu arc. The arc stands for atomic radiative capture. So enthusiasts. So there is a list of experimentalists, including some big names in the business, like Peter Kummel, who has the most precise measurement of the Higgs vacuum expectation value. Okay. So, that is G Fermi constant. And there are some PSI people, my student Anthony Frodet and David McKean and I have done some extra calculations. The data, as I said, will be taken on June 22nd, so the goal is to detect, detectors are in place from the ALCAP experiment that runs just before that. Okay, and the goal is to detect this new way of making muonic atoms via the radiative capture, and then try to detect 2s 1s transition following the atomic radiative capture or in the cascade, which is extremely difficult, but has higher rates. And of course, explore the feasibility of the future parity violating asymmetry. So with some simulations being done, so the capture into 1s state, I forgot to say, right? When the muons go in with a 50 MeV momentum, their kinetic energy is a few MeV that adds to the binding energy, and the gamma that you receive is actually well separated from the rest of the gammas. So that's what makes it makes the capture in the ground state very visible, and that's mark my words, we're going to see that process this summer, and that's gives me a slight since being doing the new physics and limits and only limits, it's nice for a change to actually participate in something that will see a definite effect. Future ideas that.
I'm a bit confused. So you had new physics in your slide in the previous one. So I mean, is it new?
There is steps, right? So to see new physics, you want to see the parity violation, say, at the level above standard model. That would be a new physics, right? But the first steps in this proposal are completely conventional physics of capture of muon in flight into the atomic state, which has never been seen. That will be seen, right, this summer. Because, okay, that's just comes from the existence of photons, muons, and nuclei, right? So it's... Or if it's if I'm wrong by a factor of 1,000, you should fire me, right?
So.
Okay. So yes, and the future ideas that I'm going to discuss next month with my colleagues over there is the different ways of making new muonic atoms, right? Where you can come in and use the fact of the binding energy of the muons inside the muonic atoms for higher Zs and knock out neutrons, which will be a higher rate than atomic radiative capture. And I also use, I'm not convinced that 2S1S transition, which has small branching after all, is the best way to see parity violation, that maybe one should go into the some nuclear excitations in these muonic atoms and see and try to detect the parity violation in E2 E1 interference. My colleagues from University of Washington, they're still hopeful that one could detect 2S1S transition in the muonic cascade using some tagging of photons of populating 2S state decaying from NP states. So there's some work going on, and I conclude that measurements of muonic lamb shift is very precise and discrepant right now at 7 sigma. Compared to measurements of, compared to expectations based on determination of charge radius with electrons, right? So this, of course, leaves a lot of question marks. What goes wrong and where? The overall kind of suspicion in the community that maybe people were way too enthusiastic about shrinking their error bars for the scattering and for normal hydrogen, right? But that's a little unfortunate because it's always a posteriori that people say, oh, well, maybe our error bars should be larger, right? So new physics looks maybe as an unlikely proposition at this point because these models have to be very tuned and very, just to explain that discrepancy. So it's not like a dark photon for G-2 where, you just add it and it fixes the problem and that's it. But it's still one of the logical possibilities. And I was also telling you that in some of these models, the enhancement, there is an enhancement of parity violating asymmetries, and that's... this is the subject I'm obsessing about because it's being suggested back in the 1970s as one of the way to test standard model before actually the parity violation in regular atoms was discovered. So it was a predecessor idea for the later beautiful measurements that people have done with parity violation in cesium where they could detect the exchange of the Z boson. And that's, I think that this will be revisited, and hopefully this year will be a trial run of trying different new ideas, but in the future there will be I hope, some process at the Paul Scherrer Institute that will go in the full gear towards trying to detect parity violation with muons in neutral currents. What's
so
that?
What are the prospects for G minus 2? Because right now it's at the 3 sigma, right?
Well, we...
And another question that's related to this, if you have a discrepancy of G minus 2, how easy it is, I mean, you build models for this, that's why I'm asking, how easy to see also a violation in a parity, a neutral current parity violation?
With G minus 2?
Yeah, with G minus 2. So these
with G minus 2, the neutral violation of parity doesn't necessarily affect G minus 2, right?
The
models you built are necessarily tuned, right? One of the things that you tune is G minus 2, unfortunately, right? I mean, so that's the scalar model that Itai have worked on that doesn't violate anything but doesn't have a UV completion and is at odds with the neutron scattering. That has a chance of actually explaining both G minus 2 of the muon and the muonic hydrogen. Okay? So for which we, like meaning Eder and Gordon and I, have very concrete proposal how one can go after that model.
So experimentally, how will we...
The experiment's going to shrink this error bar, the stated goal, by a factor of 4. How that's after many years of running, right? How realistic that is remains to be seen. I mean, in certain ways, it's the only one of the very few interesting particle physics experiments on North American soil, right? I mean, things that are in principle sensitive to the weak scale interactions and so on. So it's important that it works. How realistic? I mean, could people be wrong with the QCD calculations by a factor? You know, that instead of 9 times 10 minus 10 for the hadronic line by light, you have actually 3 times 10 minus 9. I mean, everyone says, "Wow, that's what we get." Everyone gets one and the same number, but that's a model dependent thing, right?
Any other quick questions?
I have.
Okay.
So I'm just wondering, what gives you confidence about? I mean. Calculation of QCD how extended the proton or the nucleus is
it's
strongly coupled. So I mean every approximate calculation you do, I mean there could be big corrections to it. I don't know, but I mean I guess people do lattice QCD, but that's a very limited application.
It's funny you should mention lattice QCD. The discrepancy in the charge radius is 5%. The actual observable is Rp squared. Is 10%, right? I mean, so this is within the capabilities of lattice QCD, according to them, right? For whatever mysterious reasons for me, they all prefer to work on some other problems, not on this one, right? So
I guess the people who do this calculation, they don't do lattice QCD. They have some.
No, that is nothing to do with the lattice QCD. So this thing when you just do one photon exchange and there is an uncertain form factor, this is what you extract from data, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So okay, the only question is. What happens when you have add another photon, right? And there is an excitation here, right? That thing is, as I said, there is a series of treatments.
Yeah, but if you're given a single form factor, it's an entire function. So
right. So if your space size of your proton is limited roughly to a scales set by say a pion mass, right? Then you're okay. The calculations are fine. If it's indeed there is a new infrared degree of freedom in QCD, which is an interesting thought, that extends to 200 Fermi, right? To the scale of the of
but,
the.
But, I mean, do you think it should be new physics, or it could be just non-perturbative physics?
That would be an extremely important finding if there is a non-perturbative physics that at the per mil level extends in space at 200 Fermi. So I have no. So that is easy to fix with new physics. So I would easier. It's still in my mind easier to fix to have that picture with new physics rather than with QCD doing this. Right. So that means that QCD gives some infrared degrees of freedom, which is
okay. Let's think.